This new system of psychological disorders had been created by an attack on the arrogance and power of the psychiatric elite in the name of freedom. But what was beginning to emerge from this was a new form of control. The disorders and checklists were becoming a powerful and objective guide to what were the correct and appropriate feelings in an age of individualism and emotion. But this was a very different system of order. No longer were people told how to behave by an elite. Instead, they now used the checklists to monitor their feelings and police their own behaviour. They were reassured that these new categories were scientific and could be checked by the power of numbers.
For they are the party of yesterday, and tomorrow is ours.
In 1979, Mrs. Thatcher had come to power in Britain. What she promised to create was a society based on the dream of individual freedom. People would be liberated from the arrogant elites and state bureaucrats of the past. But Mrs. Thatcher knew she would have to find a new way of managing and controlling these free individuals in a complex society in order to avoid chaos. And to do this, just like the psychiatrist in America, she would turn to systems based on the objective power of numbers. But underlying the new mathematical models would yet again be the dark and suspicious vision of human beings that the Cold War strategists had assumed. This vision would now penetrate to the very heart of the British state. The Thatcher government had begun in the early 80s by selling off many of the state-owned industries. But it soon became clear that in the modern world, there were large areas of the state which would have to remain under government control. Yet Mrs. Thatcher was determined to free them too from the old forms of management. To do this, she would bring in a system no longer run by ideas of public duty. Instead, public servants would be encouraged by incentives to follow their self-interest. It was all in keeping with the ideas of the inventor of public choice, James Buchanan. He believed that it was those politicians and bureaucrats who preached the idea of public duty that were the most dangerous, whom he called the zealots. They had to be got rid of.
We're safer if we have politicians who are a bit self-interested and greedy than if we have these zealots. The greatest danger, of course, is the zealot who thinks that he knows best or she knows best for the rest of us, as opposed to being for sale, so to speak.
So in that sense, you can then use incentives, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Can you just explain
exactly
that?
Exactly. The zealot is not nearly as readily influenced by monetary incentives or incentives of office or rents as the non-zealot. So you don't want too many zealots in there. If our success depends on the goodness of the politicians and bureaucrats, then we're in real trouble.
It was a dark and pessimistic vision of human motivation, but it was about to become the basis for a new system of managing the British state.
The proposals represent the most far-reaching reform of the National Health Service in its 40-year history. They offer new opportunities and pose new challenges for everyone concerned with the running of the service.
In 1988, Mrs. Thatcher announced a complete reform of the way the National Health Service was run. The fundamental aim was to overthrow the power of the medical establishment and replace it with a new, efficient system of management. To do this, Mrs. Thatcher turned to a man who had been one of the nuclear strategists at the RAND Corporation at the height of the Cold War. He was called Alan Enthoven. Back in the 50s, Enthoven's job had been to think the unthinkable, to plan how to fight and win a nuclear war. To do this, he had designed a mathematical system which would use nuclear weapons as rational incentives to manipulate the other side. Enthoven had designed charts that showed how many megatons of bombs to drop on which cities and how many people it would be necessary to kill to prove to the Russians that it was in their self-interest to come to the bargaining table. Out of this, Enthoven had developed a technique he called systems analysis. It was a technique of management that he believed could be applied to any type of human organisation. Its aim was to get rid of all the emotional and subjective values that confused and corrupted the system and replace them by rational, objective methods, mathematically defined targets and incentives. Enthoven had first tried to apply this system back in the 1960s when he was still in the military. The Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, asked him to help transform the way the Pentagon was run. Enthoven began by getting rid of the idea that patriotism should be the guiding force in America's defense and replacing it with a rational system based on numbers.
Alan Enthoven.
The approach we brought to the Pentagon was one based on rational behavior. Previously, that had been, at that high level, it was kind of a political thing, and we were trying to make it more an analytical thing. In defense, most people thought it ought to be done on the basis of patriotism. There was quite a bit of that emotion, feeling, are you patriotic, and so forth. And I was there with my slide rule, you know, my geeky sort of MIT style.
Airborne!
All the way, sir!
Sit down, please.
What did the military think of it all?
Well, I think that...
They hated it.
They hated it, yeah.
What replaced patriotism and notions of public duty were mathematically measurable outcomes. But McNamara's experiment had ended in disaster when he had tried to run the Vietnam War in a rational, mathematical way, through performance targets and incentives. The most infamous example had been the body count. It had been designed as a rational measure of whether America was winning the war. But in fact, troops simply made it up, or even shot civilians, to fulfill their performance targets. And in 1967, McNamara had resigned. But Enthoven was undaunted, and next he applied his systems to design a rational way of managing healthcare. He began this in America, but in 1986, Mrs. Thatcher had asked him to come and do the same for the NHS in Britain. Just as he had challenged the power of the generals in the Pentagon, now he would do the same for the doctors in Britain.
I think in both cases, with the military and in the Defense Department, and with the doctors both here and in Britain, that you have the power of organized elites, of authority and hierarchy, and the system needed to be reconfigured in such a way as to give incentives to do a better job. And it was a matter of how would you rewire the incentives to motivate the self-interest, to create proper incentives to reward efficiency, and can we measure it? So that was a challenge to the power of organized medicine.
What Enthoven proposed for the NHS, he called the internal market. In fact, what it was a mathematical simulation of the free market. Numbers were used to create measurable outputs and performance targets at all levels, while competition was created, driven by a system of incentives. All of this mimicked the pressures of the free market on public servants. To those who set out to create it, it was the engineering of a new freedom. They were liberating millions of public employees from the arrogant control of the old elites. Instead, a new and objective method, based on numbers, set the targets which individuals were then free to achieve any way they wanted.
Madison Peary, government advisor.
It basically set free their talents. Before, they had simply been instruments doing what they were told. Now, suddenly, they were creative minds allowed to examine and say, why don't we do this? And that sense of freedom that comes in thinking these were their targets, not something that had been wished on them from on high. And that was a very important part of motivation, for they felt they owned their targets.
But it was a very narrow and specific type of freedom. It meant shedding all ideas of working for the collective or public good and becoming instead an individual constantly calculating what would be to one's advantage in a system driven and defined by numbers. At the root of this were the simplified, self-interested creatures that John Nash had created back in the 1950s to make his game theory equations work. But now, the aim of the system of targets and incentives was to transform public servants into just these simplified beings. Individuals who calculated only what was best for them and did not think any longer in wider political terms.
Professor Philip Murawski.
There is this vision of these individual isolated humans, that they are only information processors, there's no emotion involved, that people don't get their some of their motives for participating in politics from, you know, emotional feelings of being part of something larger than themselves. None of that is allowed in this particular theorem. And so what we have is we have this image of these little information processors who might possibly care about their family or whatever. But, I mean, you know, the idea that they have the interests and the welfare of the whole at heart is thought to be naive.
This is the middle of the checkpoint. The gates have been opened. The police are making no attempt to stop people as they go through and come back. I have never seen such elation.
I watched the scenes on television last night and again this morning. You see the joy on people's faces and you see what freedom means to them. It makes you realize that you can't stifle or suppress people's desire for liberty.
What do you think of tonight?
It's wonderful.
In November 1989, the Berlin Wall collapsed and the Cold War was finally over. A new era of freedom had begun. But the shape that freedom was going to take would be defined by the victors, the West. And as this program has shown, the idea of freedom that had now become dominant in the West was deeply rooted in the suspicion and paranoia of the Cold War. Next week's film will show how this idea spreads to take over politics itself, because it seemed to offer a new and better alternative to democracy. What it actually leads to is corruption, growing rigidity, and the dramatic rise of inequality. And we will come to believe that we really are the strange, isolated beings that the Cold War scientists had invented to make their models work. This bleak vision, far from liberating us, will become our cage.
You've just been listening to a radio adaptation of part one of a three-part documentary series by Adam Curtis, The Trap, What Happened to Our Dream of Freedom, produced in 2007. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. We'll conclude the program with our next installment from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, beginning Chapter 18, appropriately called Breaking Out of the Trap. Gatto begins the chapter with two quotes, the first by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, as quoted by Pravda in 1986. We have a choice to make once and for all between the empire and the spiritual and physical salvation of our people. No road for the people will ever be open unless the government completely gives up control over us or any aspect of our lives. It has led the country into an abyss, and it does not know the way out. And this quote, to hell with the cheese, let's get out of this trap. A mouse. To reform our treatment of the young, we must force the center of gravity of the school world to change. In this chapter, I'll try to show you what I mean, but my method will be largely indirect. To fashion the beginnings of a solution from these materials will require your active engagement in an imaginative partnership with me, one that shall commence in Silicon Valley. I went to Silicon Valley in the middle of 1999 to speak to some computer executives at Cypress Semiconductor on the general topic of school reform. The 50 or 60 who showed up to my talk directly from work were dressed so informally they might easily have been mistaken for pizza delivery men or taxicab drivers. The CEO of the corporation, its founder, T.J. Rogers, was similarly turned out. I didn't recognize him as the same famous man portrayed on a large photo mural mounted on the wall outside until he introduced me to the audience and the audience to me. To let me know who my auditors were, Rogers said that everyone there was a millionaire. None needed to work for him because all were self-sufficient and could find work all over the place simply by walking into a different company. They worked for Cyprus because they wanted to, just as he did himself. And like him, they were usually hard at it from very early morning until long after 5 o'clock, because they wanted to. The thesis of my talk was that the history of forced schooling in America, as elsewhere, is the history of the requirements of business. School can't be satisfactorily explained by studying the careers of ideologues like Horace Mann or anyone else. The problem of American education from a personal or family perspective isn't really a problem at all from the vantage point of big business, big finance, and big government. What's a problem to me is a solution for them. An insufficient incentive exists to change things much, otherwise things would change. I learned that from Adam Smith. Smith turns out to be a much different sensibility than the priesthood of corporate apologists thinks he is. Regard it this way. In our present system, those abstract bignesses are saddled with the endless responsibility of finding a place for hundreds of millions of people, and the even more daunting challenge of creating demand for products and services which, historically viewed, few of us need or want. Because of this anomaly, a Procrustean discipline emerges in which the entire population must be continually cut or stretched to fit the momentary convenience of the economy. This is a free market only in fantasy. It seems free because ceaseless behind-the-scenes efforts maintain the illusion, but its reality is much different. Prodigies of psychological and political insight and wisdom gathered painfully over the centuries are refined into principles, taught in elite colleges, and consecrated in the service of this colossal tour de force of appearances. Let me illustrate. People love to work, but they must be convinced that work is a kind of curse, that they must arrange the maximum of leisure and labor-saving devices in their lives upon which belief many corporations depend. People love to invent solutions, to be resourceful, to make do with what they have. But resourcefulness and frugality are criminal behaviors to a mass production economy. Such examples threaten to infect others with the same fatal sedition. Similarly, people love to attach themselves to favored possessions, even to grow old and die with them. But such indulgence is dangerous lunacy in a machine economy whose costly tools are continually renewed by enormous borrowings. People like to stay put, but must be convinced they lead pinched and barren existences without travel. People love to walk, but the built world is now laid out, so they have to drive. Worst of all are those who yearn for productive, independent livelihoods like the Amish have, and nearly all free Americans once had. If that vision spreads, a consumer economy is sunk. For all these and other reasons, the form of schooling we get is largely a kind of consumer and employee training. This isn't just incidentally true. Common sense should tell you it's necessarily so if the economy is to survive in any recognizable form. Every principal institution in our culture is a partner with the particular form of corporatism which has begun to dominate America at the end of World War II. Call it paternal corporatism. Wise elites can be trained to provide for the rest of us, who will be kept as children. Unlike Plato's guardians, whom they otherwise resemble, this meritorious elite is not kept poor, but is guaranteed prosperity and status in exchange for its oversight. An essential feature of this kind of central management is that the population remain mystified, specialized, dependent, and childish. The school institution is clearly a key partner in this arrangement. It suppresses the productive impulse in favor of consumption. It redefines work as a job someone eventually gives you if you behave. It habituates a large clientele to sloth, envy, and boredom, and it accustoms individuals to think of themselves as members of a class with various distinguishing features. More than anything else, school is about class consciousness. In addition, it makes intellectual work and creative thinking appear like distasteful or difficult labor to most of us. None of this is done to oppress, but because the economy would dissolve into something else if those attitudes didn't become ingrained in childhood. We have evolved a subtly architected, delicately balanced command economy and class-based society upon which huge efforts are lavished to make it appear like something else. The illusion has been wearing thin for years. That's the principal reason why so many people don't bother to vote. In such a bargain, the quality of schooling is distinctly secondary. Other values are uppermost. A great many children see through the fraud in elementary school but lack the language and education to come to proper terms with their feelings. In this system, a fraction of the kids are slowly over time let in on a part of this managerial reality because they are intended to be eventually made into guardians themselves or guardians' assistants. School is a place where a comprehensive social vision is learned. Without a contrary vision to offer, the term school reform is only a misnomer describing trivial changes. Any large alteration of forced schooling, which might jeopardize the continuity of workers and customers that the corporate economy depends on, is unthinkable without some radical change in popular perception preceding it. Business/school partnerships and school-to-work legislation aren't positive developments, but they represent the end of any pretense that ordinary children should be educated. In any case, that was the burden of my talk at Cyprus. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. When I finished, Mr. Rogers briefly took me to task for having seemed to include in the indictment the high-tech group at Cyprus. Later, I learned that he had challenged Washington to stop government subsidies to the Valley on the grounds that such tampering destroyed the very principle that provided it with energy, open competition, and risk-taking. Thinking about his criticism on the road home, I accepted the justice of his complaint against me and his penance, thought about the significance of what he had said. A century ago, mass production began to stifle the individualism which was the real American dream. Big business, big government, and big labor couldn't deal with individuals, but only with people in bulk. Now computers seem to be shifting the balance of power from collective entities like corporations back to people. The cult of individual effort is found all over Silicon Valley, standing in sharp contrast to leadership practices based on high SAT scores, elite college degrees, and sponsorship by prominent patrons. The Valley judges people on their tangible contributions rather than on sex, seniority, old-school ties, club memberships, or family. About half the millionaires in my Cyprus audience had been foreign-born, not rich at all just a few years earlier. Many new internet firms are headed by people in their mid-20s who never wear a suit except to costume parties. 6,000 high-tech firms exist there in a non-stop entrepreneurial environment. The world's best example of Adam Smith's competitive capitalism. Companies are mostly small, personal, and fast on their feet. Traditional organization men are nowhere to be seen. They are a luxury none can afford and still remain competitive. Company mortality is high, but so is the startup rate for new firms. When unsuccessful companies die, their people and resources are recycled somewhere else. Information technology people seek to create an economy close to the model capitalism in Adam Smith's mind, a model which assumes the world to be composed not of childish and incompetent masses, but of individuals who can be trusted to pursue their own interests competently if they are first given access to accurate information and then left relatively free of interference to make something of it. The Internet advances Smith's case dramatically. Computerization is pushing political debate in a libertarian direction, linking markets to the necessary personal freedoms which markets need to work, threatening countries that fail to follow this course of streamlining government with disaster. At least this was true before the great tech wreck of 2001 and 2002. It can only be a matter of time before America rides on the back of the computer age into a new form of educational schooling, once called for by Adam Smith. That and a general reincorporation of children back into the greater social body from which they were excised a century and more ago will cure the problem of modern schooling. We can't afford to waste the resources young lives represent much longer. Nobody's that rich. Nor is anybody smart enough to marshal those resources and use them most efficiently. Individuals have to do that for themselves. On October 30, 1999, The Economist printed a warning that decision-making was being dispersed around global networks of individuals that fall beyond the control of national governments and nothing could be done about it. Quote, "Innovation is now so fast and furious that big organizations increasingly look like dinosaurs while wired individuals race past them," close quote. That critique encompasses the problem of modern schooling, which cannot educate for fear the social order will explode. Yet the siliconizing of the industrial world is upending hierarchies based on a few knowing inside information and a mass knowing relatively less in descending layers, right on down to school children, given propaganda and fairy tales in place of knowledge. The full significance of what Adam Smith saw several centuries ago is hardly well understood today, even among those who claim to be his descendants. He saw that human potential once educated was beyond the reach of any system of analysis to comprehend or predict, or of any system of regulation to enhance. Fixed orders of social hierarchy and economic destiny are barricades put up to stem the surprising human inventiveness, which would surely turn the world inside out if unleashed. They secure privilege by holding individuals in place. Smith saw that over time, wealth would follow the release of constraints on human inventiveness and imagination. The larger the group invited to play, the more spectacular the results. For all the ignorance and untrustworthiness in the world, he correctly perceived that the overwhelming majority of human beings could indeed be trusted to act in a way that over time is good for all. The only kind of education this system needs to be efficient is intellectual schooling for all, schooling to enlarge the imagination and strengthen the natural abilities to analyze, experiment, and communicate. Bringing up the young in somebody else's grand socialization scheme, or bringing them up to play a fixed role in the existing economy and society and nothing more, is like setting fire to a fortune and burning it up because you don't understand money. Smith would recognize our current public schools as the same kind of indoctrination project for the masses, albeit infinitely subtler, that the Hindus employed for centuries, a project whose attention is directed to the stability of the social order through constraint of opportunity. What a hideous waste, he might exclaim. The great achievement of Wealth of Nations, and that's the book by Adam Smith, resides in its conviction and demonstration that people individually do best for everyone when they do best for themselves, when they aren't commanded too much or protected against the consequences of their own folly. As long as we have a free market and a free society, Smith trusts us to be able to manage any problems that appear. It's only when we vest authority and the problem-solving ability in a few that we become caught in a trap of our own making. The wild world of Silicon Valley mavericks and their outriggers is a hint of a dynamic America to come where responsibility, trust, and great expectations are once again given to the young as they were in Ben Franklin's day. That's how we'll break out of the school trap. Ask yourself where and how these Silicon kids really learned what they knew. The answer isn't found in memorizing a script. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In the northeast corner of an island, a long way from here, a woman sells plates of cooked shrimp and rice from out of an old white truck. Her truck is worth $5,000 at most. She sells only that one thing, plus hot dogs for the kids and canned soda. The license to do this costs $500 a year, or $43.25 a month, a little over a dollar a day. The shrimp lady is 59 years old. She has a high school diploma and a nice smile. Her truck parks on a gravel pull-off from the main highway in a nondescript location. No one else is around, not because the shrimp lady has a protected location, but because no one else wants to be there. A hand-lettered sign advertises, $9.95 shrimp and rice, soda $1, hot dogs $1.25. The day I stood in line for a shrimp plate, five customers were in front of me. They bought 14 plates among them and 14 sodas. I bought two and two when it came my turn, and by that time, five new customers had arrived behind me. I was intrigued. The next day, Janet and I returned. We parked across the road where we could watch the truck but not make the shrimp lady nervous. In 2 hours, 41 plates and 41 sodas were handed out of the old truck and maybe 10 hot dogs. A week later, we came back and watched again as nearly the same thing happened. Janet, a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America, estimated that $7 of the $10.95 for shrimp and soda was profit after all costs. Later, we chatted with a lady in a quiet moment. The truck sits there 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, 364 days a year. The island is warm year-round. It averages 100 to 150 shrimp sales a day, but has sold as many as 300. When the owner proprietress isn't there, one of her three daughters takes over. Each is only a high school graduate. For all I know, the only thing saleable any one of them knows how to do is cook shrimp and rice, but they do that very well. The family earns in excess of $250,000 a year selling shrimp plates out of an old truck. They have no interest in expanding or franchising the business. Another thing I noticed, all the customers seemed pleased. Many were friendly and joked with the lady, myself included. She looked happy to be alive. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. A prophetic article entitled The Laboring Classes appeared in the Boston Quarterly Review in 1840, at the very moment Horace Mann's crowd was beating the drum loudest for compulsion schooling. Its author, Orestes Brownson, charged that Horace Mann was trying to establish a state church in America like the one England had, and to impose a merchant industrialist worldview as its gospel. Quote, a system of education so constituted may as well be a religion established by law, said Brownson. Mann's business backers were trying, he thought, to set up a new division of labor, giving licensed professional specialists a monopoly to teach, weakening people's capacity to educate themselves, making them childlike. Teaching in a democracy belongs to the whole community, not to any centralized monopoly, said Brownson. And children were far better educated by the general pursuits, habits, and moral tone of the community than by a privileged class. The mission of this country, according to Brownson, was to raise up the laboring classes and make every man really free and independent, close quote. Whatever schooling should be admitted to society under the auspices of government should be dedicated to the principle of independent livelihoods and close, self-reliant families. Brownson's freedom and independence are still the goals that represent a consensus of working class opinion in America, although they have receded out of reach for all but a small fraction, like the shrimp lady. How close was the nation in 1840 to realizing such a dream of equality before forced schooling converted our working classes into human resources or a workforce for the convenience of the industrial order? The answer is very close, as significant clues testify. A century and a half after The Laboring Classes was published, Cornell labor scholar Chris Clark investigated and corroborated the reality of Brownson's world. In his book, Roots of Rural Capitalism, Clark found that the general labor market in the Connecticut Valley was highly undependable in the 1840s by employer standards because it was shaped by family concerns. Outside work could only be fitted into what available free-time farming allowed, for farming took priority, and work was adapted to the homespun character of rural manufacture in a system we find alive today among the Amish. Wage labor was not dependent on a boss's whim. It had a mind of its own and was always only a supplement to a broad strategy of household economy. A successful tradition of self-reliance requires an optimistic theory of human nature to bolster it. Revolutionary America had a belief in common people never seen anywhere in the past. Before such an independent economy could be broken apart and scavenged for its labor units, people had to be brought to believe in a different, more pessimistic appraisal of human possibility. Abe Lincoln once called this contempt for ordinary people mudsill theory, an attitude that the education of working men and women was useless and dangerous. It was the same argument, not incidentally, that the British state and church made and enforced for centuries, German principalities and their official church, too. Lincoln said in a speech to the Wisconsin Agricultural Society in September 1859 that the goal of government planning should be independent livelihoods. He thought everyone was capable of reaching that goal, as it is reached in Amish households today. Lincoln characterized mudsill theory as a distortion of human nature, cynical and self-serving in its central contention that, quote, nobody labors unless someone else owning capital by the use of that capital induces him to it. Having assumed this, they proceed to consider whether it is best the capital shall hire laborers and thus induce them to work by their own consent, or buy them and drive them to it without their consent. Having proceeded so far, they naturally conclude that all laborers are necessarily either hired laborers or slaves. They further assume that whoever is once a hired laborer is fatally fixed in the condition for life, and thence again that his condition is as bad or worse as that of a slave. This is the mudsill theory. Close quote. This notion was contradicted, said Lincoln, by an inconvenient fact. A large majority in the free states were neither hirers nor hired, and wage labor served only as a temporary condition leading to small proprietorship. This was Abraham Lincoln's perception of the matter. Even more important was his affirmation. He testified to the rightness of this policy as a national mission, and the evidence that he thought himself onto something important was that he repeated this mudsill analysis in his first State of the Union speech to Congress in December 1861. Here in the 21st century, it hardly seems possible, this conceit of Lincoln's. Yet, there is the baffling example of the Amish experiment. Its families holding nearly universal proprietorship in farms or small enterprises, a fact which looms larger and larger in my own thinking about schools, school curricula, and the national mission of pedagogy as I grow old. That Amish prosperity wasn't handed to them, but achieved in the face of daunting odds, against active enmity from the states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, and elsewhere, and hordes of government agencies seeking to de-Amish them. That the Amish have survived and prevailed against high odds puts a base of realistic possibility under Lincoln and Brownson's small market perspective as the proper goal for schooling. An anti-mudsill curriculum once again, one worthy of another civil war, if need be. It takes no great intellect to see that such a curriculum taught in today's economic environment would directly attack the dominant economy. Not intentionally, but lack of malice would be poor compensation for those whose businesses would inevitably wither and die as the idea spread. How many microbreweries would it take to ruin Budweiser? How many solar cells and methane gas home generators to bring Exxon to its knees? This is one reason, I think, that many alternative school ideas which work and are cheap and easy to administer fizzle rather than catch fire in the public imagination. The incentive to support projects wholeheartedly when they would incidentally eliminate your livelihood or indeed eliminate the familiar society and relationships you hold dear just isn't there, nor is it easy to see how it ever could be. Why would anyone who makes a living selling goods or services be enthusiastic about schools that teach less is more, or teach that television, even PBS, alters the mind for the worse? When I see the dense concentration of big business names associated with school reform, I get a little crazy. Not because they are bad people, most are no worse than you or I, but because humanity's best interests and corporate interests cannot ever really be a good fit, except by accident. The souls of free and independent men and women are mutilated by the necessary soullessness of corporate organization and decision-making. Think of cigarettes as a classic case in point. The truth is that even if all corporate production were pure and faultless, there is still an excess of organization where the few make decisions for the many that is choking us to death. Strength, joy, wisdom are only available to those who produce their own lives, never to those who merely consume the production of others. Nothing good can come from inviting global corporations to design our schools any more than leaving a hungry dog to guard ham sandwiches is a good way to protect lunch. All training, except the most basic, either secures or disestablishes things as they are. The familiar government school curriculum represents enshrined mudsill theory, telling us people would do nothing if they weren't tricked, bribed, or intimidated, proving scientifically that workers are for the most part biologically incompetent, strung out on a bell curve. Mudsill theory has become institutionalized with buzzers, routines, standardized assessments, and terminal rankings interleaved with an interminable presentation of carrots and sticks, the positive and negative reinforcement schedules of behavioral psychology screening children for a corporate order. Mudsillism is deeply ingrained in the whole work-school-media constellation. Getting rid of it will be a devilish task with no painless transition formula. This is going to hurt when it happens, and it will happen. The current order is too far off the track of human nature, too dispirited to survive. Any economy in which the most common tasks are the shuffling of paper, the punching of buttons, and the running of mouths isn't an order into which we should be pushing kids, as if such jobs were the avenue to a good life. At the heart of any school reforms that aren't simply turning the mudsill mechanism lie two beliefs. One, that talent, intelligence, grace, and high accomplishment are within the reach of every kid. And two, that we are better off working for ourselves than for a boss. But how on earth can you believe these things in the face of a century of institution shaping, economy shaping, monopoly schooling which claims something different? Or in the face of a constant stream of media menace that jobs are vanishing, that the workplace demands more regulation and discipline, that foreign competition will bury us if we don't comply with expert prescriptions in the years ahead? One powerful antidote to such propaganda comes from looking at evidence which contradicts official propaganda. Like women who earn as much as doctors by selling shrimp from old white trucks parked beside the road, or 13-year-old boys who don't have time to waste in school because they expect to be independent businessmen before most kids are out of college. Meet Stanley. I once had a 13-year-old Greek boy named Stanley who only came to school one day a month and got away with it because I was his homeroom teacher and doctored the records. I did it because Stanley explained to me where he spent his time instead. It seems Stanley had 5 aunts and uncles, all in business for themselves before they were 21. A florist, an unfinished furniture builder, a delicatessen owner, a small restaurateur, and a delivery service operator. Stanley was passed from store to store doing free labor in exchange for an opportunity to learn the business. This way, I decide which business I like well enough to set up for myself, he told me. You tell me what books to read and I'll read them, but I don't have time to waste in school unless I want to end up like the rest of these people, working for somebody else. After I heard that, I couldn't in good conscience keep him locked up. Could you? If you say yes, tell me why. Look at those 150,000 old order Amish in 22 states and several foreign countries, nearly crime-free, prosperous, employed almost totally at independent livelihoods, proprietors with only a 5% rate of failure compared to the 85% for businesses in non-Amish hands. I hope that makes you think a little. Amish success isn't even possible according to Mudsill theory. They couldn't have happened, and yet they did. While they are still around, they give the lie to everything you think you know about the inevitability of anything. Focus on the Amish next time you hear some jerk say your children better shape up and toe the corporate line if they hope to be among the lucky survivors in the coming world economy. Why do they need to be hired hands at all? You should ask yourself. Indeed, why do you? And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The simple truth is there is no way to control this massive corporate school thing from the human end. It has to be broken up. It has become a piece of autonomous technology. Its leadership is bankrupt in ideas. Merchants are merchants, not moral leaders or political ones. It is surely a sign of retrogression, not advance, that we have forgotten what the world's peoples knew forever. A merchant has the same right to offer his opinion as I do, but it makes little sense for people who buy and sell soap and cigarettes to tell you how to raise your kid or what to believe in. No more sense than it does for a pedagogue to do the same. How would a huckster who pushes toothpaste, a joker who vends cigarettes, or a video dream peddler know anything about leading nations or raising children correctly? Are these to be the Washingtons, Jacksons, and Lincolns of the 21st century? The timeless core of Western tradition, which only the cowardly and the corrupt would wish to surrender, shows that we can't grow into the truth of our own nature without local traditions and values at the center of things. We do not do well as human beings in those abstract associations for material advantage favored by merchants called networks, or in megalithic systems, whether governmental or institutional or corporate. In his book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell put his finger on the heart of the matter, quote, "It is an Oriental model. One of the typical things of the Orient is that any criticism disqualifies you for the guru's instruction. Well, in heaven's name, is that appropriate for a Western mind? It is simply a transforming of your submission to a childhood father onto a father for your adulthood, which means you're not growing up. The thing about the guru in the West is that he represents an alien principle, namely, that you don't follow your own path, you follow a given path. And that's totally contrary to the Western spirit. Our spirituality is of the individual quest, individual realization, authenticity in your own life out of your own center." Close quote. Mario Savio, the 1960s campus radical, stood once on the steps of Sproul Hall, Berkeley, and screamed, "There is a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, that you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who own it that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. Close quote. Limiting the power of government in order to liberate the individual was the great American revolutionary insight. Too much cooperation, avoiding conflict from ordinary people, these things aren't acceptable in America, although they may suit China, Indonesia, Britain, or Germany just fine. In America, the absence of conflict is a sign of regression toward a global mean. Hardly any progress by our lights if you've seen much of the governance of the rest of the world, where common people are crushed like annoying insects if they argue. Now, I just want to interject that really smacks of American exceptionalism. And I just can't agree with that. Continuing. Karl Schurz, the German immigrant, said upon seeing America for the first time in 1848, "Here you can see how slightly a people needs to be governed." Close quote. What it will take to break collectively out of this trap is a change in the nature of forced schooling, one which alters the balance of power between societies and systems in favor of societies again. We need once more to debate angrily the purpose of public education. The power of elites to set the agenda for public schooling has to be challenged, an agenda which includes totalitarian labeling of the ordinary population, unwanted official prerogatives, and near total control of work. Until such a change happens, we need to individually withhold excessive allegiance from any and all forms of abstract, remotely displaced political and economic leadership. We need to trust ourselves and our children to make the future locally. Demand that intellectual and character development once again be the mission of schools. We need to smash the government monopoly over the upbringing of our young by forcing it to compete for funds whose commitments should rest largely on the judgment of parents and local associations. Where argument, court action, foot-dragging, and polite subversion can't derail this judgment, then we must find the courage to be saboteurs, as the Maquis did in occupied France during World War II. "It isn't difficult," someone once said, "to imagine young Bill Clinton sitting at the feet of his favorite old professor, Dr. Carroll Quigley of Georgetown. As Quigley approached death, he came back to Georgetown one last time in 1976 to deliver the Oscar Iden lecture series. The Quigley of the Iden lectures said many things which anticipate the argument of my own book. His words often turn to the modern predicament, the sense of impending doom many of us feel." Quote, "The fundamental all-pervasive cause of world instability is the destruction of communities by the commercialization of all human relationships and the resulting neuroses and psychoses. Another cause of today's instability is that we now have a society which is totally dominated by the two elements of sovereignty that are not included in the state structure, control of credit and banking, and the corporation. These are free from political controls and social responsibility. The only element of production they are concerned with is the one they can control, capital." Close quote. Quigley alludes to a startling ultimate solution to our problems with school and with much else in our now state-obsessed lives, a drawing of critical awareness. Quote, "Out of the dark age that followed the collapse of the Carolingian Empire came the most magnificent thing. The recognition that people can have a society without having a state. In other words, this experience wiped out the assumption that is found through classical antiquity, except among unorthodox and heretical thinkers, that the state and society are identical, and therefore you can desire nothing more than to be a citizen." Close quote. A society without a state. And I'd like to interject here, if you would like to understand more about that idea, get on the web and Google anarchism. Continuing with Gatto. If the only value hard reading had was to be able to tune in on minds like Quigley's, minds free of fetters, sharp axes with which to strike off chains, that alone would be reason enough to put such reading at the heart of a new kind of schooling, which might strongly resemble the education America offered 150 years ago, a movement to ennoble common people, freeing them from the clutches of masters, experts, and those terrifying true believers whose eyes gleam in the dark. Quigley thought such a transformation was inevitable. Quote, "Now I come to my last statement. I'm not personally pessimistic. The final result will be that the American people will ultimately opt out of the system. Today, everything is a bureaucratic structure, and brainwashed people who are not personalities are trained to fit into this bureaucratic structure and say it's a great life, although I would assume that many on their deathbeds must feel otherwise. The process of copping out will take a long time, but notice, we are already copping out of military service on a wholesale basis. We are already copping out of voting on a large-scale basis. People are also copping out by refusing to pay any attention to newspapers or to what's going on in the world, and by increasing emphasis on the growth of localism, what is happening in their own neighborhoods. When Rome fell, the Christian answer was, create our own communities." Close quote. We shall do that again. When we want better families, better neighbors, better friends, and better schools, we shall turn our backs on national and global systems, on experts, and specialist specialties, and begin to make our own schools one by one, far from the reach of systems. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. You can find out more about his work and download this entire book for free online on the web at johntaylorgatto.com. For local listeners in the Finger Lakes that would like to learn the skills of freedom, there's a great opportunity at the New York Green Fest 2007. It's going to take place over 3 days, August 10th through 12th, in Ithaca and Cayuteville. Friday night in Ithaca, from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Community School at 330 East State Street, there'll be a program on the politics of sustainability. The three speakers will address the power relationships that promote sustainability will be Art Weaver from Renovus Energy in Ithaca, Virginia Rasmussen from Alfred, one of the founders of the program on corporations, law, and democracy, and Dan Hill, Cayuga Nation representative to the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force. Dan will open and close the program with native flute music. Saturday's programs take place at Cayuta Sun, an off-the-grid permaculture homestead at 2962 Swamp Road in Cayutaville. The day begins at 8:30 a.m. with a bread baking workshop in the Earth Oven. You'll hear from local farmers about growing your own food, workshops on permaculture, organizing sustainability skills, living off the grid, and how to build a small wind turbine. That and much, much more. On Sunday, August 12th, Greenfest moves to the Ithaca Commons downtown with a series of speakers and musicians. There'll be demonstrations on how to make a green roof and a discussion on building new media outlets that address sustainability issues, using third-party electoral activism to foster social change and challenge the underpinnings of corporate power, and a discussion on campus organizing. There's much too much information for me to read on the air. There are various admissions and fees charged for things. I suggest you just go to the web and look up nygreenfest.blogspot.com, nygreenfest.blogspot.com, or call 607-539-2114, 607-539-2114. Thank you for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests, and you can download this program and all our previous ones from the archive at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Bell.
and spread it out equal, just like.